89%, believing in God. And my more than 10 million readers are a pretty typical cross-section of this country. A comprehensive demographic study of more than 230 countries and territories conducted by the Pew Research Center's Forum on Religion and Public Life estimates that there are 6.1 billion religiously affiliated adults and children around the globe, representing 84% of the 2015 world population of 7.3 billion. That demographic study, based on analysis of more than 2,500 censuses, surveys, and population registers, found there are 2.3 billion Christians, 31% of the world's population, in the world, 1.8 billion Muslims, 24%, 1.1 billion Hindus, 15%, nearly 500 million Buddhists, 7%, and 14.6 million Jews, 0.2%, as of 2015, the most recent year for which we have figures. This book is used by 10 million readers in 26 countries around the world. So leaving out a section that 84% of my readers worldwide might be interested in and helped by, in order to please just 16% of my readers, seems to me insane. Indeed, according to the Pew Research Center, over 75% of the world's population lives in areas with severe religious restrictions. That's restrictions against Muslims, Jews, Christians, and other religions. According to the United States Department of State, Christians in more than 60 countries face persecution from their governments or surrounding neighbors simply because of their belief in Jesus Christ. Christians have now experienced the full impact of the world's hostility and indifference. We are staggered and alarmed by the extent of it, and dumbfounded by its partial success. Numerically, we are drastically reduced, proportionately to the enormously increased population, and we shall probably continue in that way, perhaps with even greater numerical reductions. No doubt we survive as a minority, but by no means as a pitiful or contemptible minority. We die daily because of our own weakness and unworthiness. Yet we live, nevertheless, because God is with us. Modern man relies on nothing that will not someday be taken away from him. Those who are utterly committed to the Christian faith rely, in the last resort, on nothing that could possibly be taken away. That is why the church, contrary to all appearances, is stronger than the world, and that is why it is the duty of Christians to be sympathetic, compassionate, and merciful in their dealings with their estranged brethren. I do not want to add to that feeling by keeping silent. Faith is welcome in this book. As I started writing this section, I toyed at first with the idea of following what might be described as an all-paths approach to religion, trying to stay as general and non-specific as I could. But, after much thought, I decided not to try that. This because I have read many other writers who tried, and I felt the approach failed miserably. An all-paths approach to religion ends up being a no-paths approach, just as a woman or man who tries to please everyone ends up pleasing no one. It is the old story of the universal versus the particular. Those of us who do career counseling could predict, ahead of time, that trying to stay universal is not likely to be helpful in writing about faith. We know well from our own field that truly helpful career counseling depends on defining the particularity or uniqueness of each person we try to help. No employer wants to know what you have in common with everyone else. He or she wants to know what makes you unique and individual. As I have argued throughout this book, the inventory of your uniqueness or particularity is crucial if you are ever to find meaningful work. This particularity invades everything a person does. It is not suddenly jettisonable when he or she turns to matters of faith. Therefore, when I or anyone else writes about faith, I believe we must write out of our own particularity, which starts, in my case, with the fact that I write and think and breathe as a Christian, as you might expect from the fact that I was an ordained Episcopalian minister for many years. Understandably, then, this chapter speaks from a Christian perspective. I want you to be aware of that at the outset. Balanced against this is the fact that I have always been acutely sensitive to the fact that this is a pluralistic society in which we live, and that I, in particular, owe a great deal to my readers who have religious convictions quite different from my own. It has turned out that the people who work or have worked here in my office with me over the years have been predominantly of other faiths. Furthermore, Parachute's more than 10 million readers have included not only Christians of every variety and persuasion, Christian Scientists, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, and adherents of Islam, but also believers in New Age religions, secularists, humanists, agnostics, atheists, and many others. I have therefore tried to be very courteous toward the feelings of all my readers, while at the same time counting on them to translate my Christian thought forms into their own. This ability to thus translate is the indispensable sine qua non of anyone who wants to communicate helpfully with others in this pluralistic society of ours. In the Judeo-Christian tradition from which I come, one of the indignant biblical questions was, "Has God forgotten to be gracious?" The answer was a clear no. I think it is important for all of us also to seek the same goal. I have therefore labored to make this chapter gracious, as well as thought-provoking. Turning point. For many of us, the job hunt offers a chance to make some fundamental changes in our whole life. It marks a turning point in how we live our life. It gives us a chance to ponder and reflect, to extend our mental horizons, to go deeper into the subsoil of our soul. It gives us a chance to wrestle with the question, why am I here on earth? We don't want to feel that we are just another grain of sand lying on the beach called humanity, unnumbered and lost in the billions of other human beings. We want to do more than plod through life, going to work, coming home from work. We want to find that special joy that no one can take from us, which comes from having a sense of mission in our life. We want to feel we were put here on earth for some special purpose, to do some unique work that only we can accomplish. We want to know what our mission is. The meaning of the word mission. When used with respect to our life and work, mission has always been a religious concept from beginning to end. It is defined by Webster's as a continuing task or responsibility that one is destined or fitted to do or specially called upon to undertake, and historically has had two major synonyms, calling and vocation. These, of course, are the same word in two different languages, English and Latin. Both imply God. To be given a vocation or calling implies someone who calls. To have a destiny implies someone who determined the destination for us. Thus, the concept of mission lands us inevitably in the lap of God before we have hardly begun. I emphasize this because there is an increasing trend in our culture to try to speak about religious subjects without reference to God. This is true of spirituality, soul, and mission in particular. More and more books talk about mission as though it were simply a purpose you choose for your own life by identifying your enthusiasms. This attempt to obliterate all reference to God from the originally religious concept of mission is particularly ironic because the proposed substitute word, enthusiasms, is derived from two Greek words, entheos, and means God in us. In the midst of this increasingly secular culture, we find an oasis that, along with athletics, is very hospitable toward belief in God. That oasis is job hunting. Most of the leaders who have evolved creative job hunting ideas were, from the beginning, people who believed firmly in God and said so. Sidney Fine, Bernard Haldane, John Crystal, Arthur and Marie Kern, Arthur Miller, Tom and Ellie Jackson, Ralph Mattson, and of course myself. I mentioned at the beginning of this appendix that 89% of us in the U.S. believe in God. According to the Gallup organization, 90% of us pray, 88% of us believe God loves us, and 33% of us report that we have had a life-changing religious experience. However, it is not clear that we have made much connection between our belief in God and our work. Often, our spiritual beliefs and our attitude toward our work live in separate mental ghettos within our mind. A dialogue between these two is opened up inside our head and heart when we are out of work. Unemployment, particularly in this brutal economy, gives us a chance to contemplate why we are here on earth and what our calling, vocation, or mission is uniquely for each of us. Unemployment becomes life transition when we can't find a job doing the same work we've always done. Since we have to rethink one thing, many of us elect to rethink everything. Something awakens within us. Call it yearning, call it hope. We come to realize the dream we dreamed has never died, and we go back to get it. We decide to resume our search for the life we know within our heart that we were meant to live. Now we have a chance to marry our work and our religious beliefs, to talk about calling and vocation and mission in life, to think out why we are here and what plans God has for us. That's why a period of unemployment can absolutely change our life. The secret to finding your mission in life, taking it in stages. I will explain the steps toward finding your mission in life that I have learned in all my years on earth. Just remember two things. First, I speak from a lifelong Christian perspective and trust you to translate this into your own thought forms. Second, I know that these steps are not the only way. Many people have discovered their mission by taking other paths, and you may too. But hopefully what I have to say may shed some light upon whatever path you take. I have learned that if you want to figure out what your mission in life is, it will likely take some time. It is not a problem to be solved in a day and a night. It is a learning process that has steps to it, much like the process by which we all learn to eat. As a baby, we did not tackle adult food right off. As we all recall, there were three stages. First, there had to be the mother's milk or bottle, then strained baby foods, and finally, after teeth and time, the stuff that grown-ups chew. Three stages, and the two earlier stages were not to be disparaged. It was all eating, just different forms of eating, appropriate to our development at the time. But each stage had to be mastered, in turn, before the next could be approached. There are usually three stages also to learning what your mission in life is, and the two earlier stages are likewise not to be disparaged. It is all mission, just different forms of mission appropriate to your development at the time. But each stage has to be mastered, in turn, before the next can be approached. Of course, there is a sense in which you never master any of these stages, but are always growing in understanding and mastery of them throughout your whole life here on earth. As it has been impressed on me by observing many people over the years, admittedly through Christian spectacles, it appears that the three parts to your mission here on earth can be defined generally as follows. 1. Your first mission here on earth is one that you share with the rest of the human race, but it is no less your individual mission for the fact that it is shared, and it is to seek to stand hour by hour in the conscious presence of God, the one from whom your mission is derived. The missioner before the mission is the rule. In religious language, your mission here is to know God and enjoy Him forever, and to see His hand in all His works. 2. Second, once you have begun doing that in an earnest way, your second mission here on Earth is also one that you share with the rest of the human race, but it is no less your individual mission for the fact that it is shared. And that is to do what you can, moment by moment, day by day, step by step, to make this world a better place, following the leading and guidance of God's Spirit within you and around you. 3. Third, once you have begun doing that in a serious way, your third mission here on Earth is one that is uniquely yours, and that is, A, to exercise the talent that you particularly came to Earth to use, your greatest gift, which you most delight to use. B, in the places or settings that God has caused to appeal to you the most. C, and for those purposes that God most needs to have done in the world. When fleshed out and spelled out, I think you will find that there you have the definition of your mission in life. Or to put it another way, these are the three missions that you have in life. The two rhythms of the dance of mission: unlearning, learning, unlearning, learning. The distinctive characteristic of these three stages is that in each, we are forced to let go of some fundamental assumptions that our culture has taught us about the nature of mission. In other words, throughout this quest, and at each stage, we find ourselves engaged not merely in a process of learning, we are also engaged in a process of unlearning. Thus, we can restate the three learnings in terms of what we also need to unlearn at each stage. We need, in the first stage, to unlearn the idea that our mission is primarily to keep busy doing something here on Earth, and learn instead that our mission is first of all to keep busy being something here on Earth. In Christian language, and others as well, we might say that we were sent here to learn how to be sons of God and daughters of God before anything else. Our Father who art in heaven. In the second stage, being issues into doing. At this stage, we need to unlearn the idea that everything about our mission must be unique to us, and learn instead that some parts of our mission here on Earth are shared by all human beings. For example, we were all sent here to bring more gratitude, more kindness, more forgiveness, and more love into the world. We share this mission because the task is too large to be accomplished by just one individual. We need, in the third stage, to unlearn the idea that the part of our mission that is truly unique and most truly ours is something our Creator just orders us to do without any agreement from our spirit, mind, and heart. On the other hand, neither is it something that each of us chooses and then merely asks God to bless. We need to learn that God so honors our free will that He has ordained that our unique mission be something that we have some part in choosing. In this third stage, we need also to unlearn the idea that our unique mission must consist of some achievement for all the world to see, and learn instead that as the stone does not always know what ripples it has caused in the pond whose surface it impacts, so neither we nor those who watch our life will always know what we have achieved by our life and by our mission. It may be that by the grace of God we helped bring about a profound change for the better in the lives of other souls around us. But it may also be that this takes place beyond our sight, or after we have gone on. And we may never know what we have accomplished until we see Him face to face after this life is past. Most finally, we need to unlearn the idea that what we have accomplished is our doing and ours alone. It is God's Spirit breathing in us and through us that helps us do whatever we do. And so the singular first-person pronoun is never appropriate, but only the plural. Not, "I accomplished this," but, "We accomplished this, God and I working together." That should give you a general overview. But I would like to add some random comments on my part about each of these three missions of ours here on Earth. Some random comments about your first mission in life. Your first mission here on Earth is one that you share with the rest of the human race, but it is no less your individual mission for the fact that it is shared, and that is to seek to stand hour by hour in the conscious presence of God, the one from whom your mission is derived. The missioner before the mission is the rule. In religious language, your mission is to know God and enjoy Him forever and to see His hand in all His works. Comment 1. How we might think of God. Each of us has to go about this primary mission according to the tenets of our own particular religion. But I will speak what I know out of the context of my own particular faith, and you may perhaps translate and apply it to yours. I will speak as a Christian who believes, passionately, that Christ is the way and the truth and the life. But I also believe, with St. Peter, that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears Him and does what is right is acceptable to Him. Acts chapter 10, verses 34 to 35. Now, Jesus claimed many unique things about Himself and His mission, but He also spoke of Himself as the great prototype for us all. He called Himself the Son of Man, and He said, I assure you that the man who believes in Me will do the same things that I have done, yes, and he will do even greater things than these. John chapter 14, verse 12. Emboldened by His identification of us with His life and His mission, we might want to remember how He spoke about His life here on earth. He put it in this context. I come from the Father and have come into the world. Again, I am leaving the world and going to the Father. John chapter 16, verse 28. If there is a sense in which this is, in even the faintest way, true also of our lives, and I shall say in a moment in what sense I think it is true, then instead of calling our great Creator God or Father right off, we might begin our approach to the subject of religion by referring to the One who gave us our mission and sent us to this planet not as God or Father, but, just to help our thinking, as the One from whom we came and the One to whom we shall return when this life is done. If our life here on earth is to be at all like Christ's, then this is a true way to think about the One who gave us our mission. We are not some kind of eternal, pre-existent being. We are creatures who once did not exist and then came into being and continue to have our being only at the will of our great Creator. But as creatures, we are both body and soul. Although we know our body was created in our mother's womb, our soul's origin is a great mystery. Where it came from, at what moment the Lord created it, is something we cannot know. It is not unreasonable to suppose, however, that the great God created our soul before it entered our body, and in that sense we did indeed stand before God before we were born, and He is indeed the One from whom we came and the One to whom we shall return. Therefore, before we go searching for what work was I sent here to do, we need to establish, or in a truer sense, re-establish, contact with the One from whom we came and the One to whom we shall return. Without this reaching out of the creature to the great Creator, without this reaching out of the creature with a mission to the One who gave us that mission, the question, what is my mission in life, is void and null. The what is rooted in the who. Absent the personal, one cannot meaningfully discuss the thing. It is like the adult who cries, I want to get married, without giving any consideration to who it is they want to marry. Comment 2. How we might think of religion or faith. In light of this larger view of our creatureliness, we can see that religion or faith is not a question of whether or not we choose to, as it is so commonly put, have a relationship with God. Looking at our life in a larger context than just our life here on earth, it becomes apparent that some sort of relationship with God is a given for us, about which we have absolutely no choice. God and we were and are related during the time of our soul's existence before our birth and in the time of our soul's continued existence after our death. The only choice we have is what to do about the time in between, that is, what we want the nature of our relationship with God to be during our time here on earth, and how that will affect the nature of the relationship then after death. One of the corollaries of all this is that by the very act of being born into a human body, it is inevitable that we undergo a kind of amnesia. An amnesia that typically embraces not only our 9 months in the womb, our baby years, and almost one-third of each day, sleeping, but more important, any memory of our origin or our destiny. We wander on earth as an amnesia victim. To seek after faith, therefore, is to seek to climb back out of that amnesia. Religion or faith is the hard reclaiming of knowledge we once knew as a certainty. Comment 3. The first obstacle to executing this mission. This first mission of ours here on earth is not the easiest of missions, simply because it is the first. Indeed, in many ways, it is the most difficult. All we can see is that our life here on earth is a very physical life. We eat, we drink, we sleep, we long to be held and to hold. We inherit a physical body with very physical appetites. We walk on the physical earth, and we acquire physical possessions. It is the most alluring of temptations, in our amnesia, to come up with just a physical interpretation of this life, to think that the universe is merely interested in the survival of species. Given this interpretation, the story of our individual life could be simply told. We are born, grow up, procreate, and die. But we are ever recalled to do what we came here to do, that without rejecting the joy of the physicalness of this life, such as the love of the blue sky and the green grass, we are to reach out beyond all this to recall and recover a spiritual interpretation of our life. Beyond the physical, and within the physicalness of this life, to detect a spirit and a person from beyond this earth who is with us and in us, the very real and loving and awesome presence of the great Creator from whom we came, and the one to whom we once again shall go. Comment 4. The second obstacle to executing this mission. It is one of the conditions of our earthly amnesia and our creatureliness that, sadly enough, some very human and very rebellious part of us likes the idea of living in a world where we can be our own God, and therefore loves the purely physical interpretation of life, and finds it anguish to relinquish it. Traditional Christian vocabulary calls this sin, and has a lot to say about the difficulty it poses for this first part of our mission. All who live a thoughtful life know that it is true. Our greatest enemy in carrying out this first mission of ours is indeed our own heart and our own rebellion. Comment 5. Further thoughts about what makes us special and unique. As I said earlier, many of us come to this issue of our mission in life because we want to feel that we are unique. And what we mean by that is that we hope to discover some specialness intrinsic to us, which is our birthright, and which no one can take from us. What we, however, discover from a thorough exploration of this topic is that we are indeed special, but only because God thinks us so. Our specialness and uniqueness reside in Him and His love, rather than in anything intrinsic to our own being. The proper appreciation of this distinction causes our feet to carry us in the end not to the city called pride, but to the temple called gratitude. What is religion? Religion is the service of God out of grateful love for what God has done for us. The Christian religion, more particularly, is the service of God out of grateful love for what God has done for us in Christ. Philip Brooks, author of O Little Town of Bethlehem. Comment 6. The unconscious doing of the work we came to do. You may have already wrestled with this first part of your mission here on earth. You may not have called it that. You may have called it simply learning to believe in God. But if you ask what your mission is in life, this one was and is the precondition of all else that you came here to do. Absent this mission, it is folly to talk about the rest. So if you have been seeking faith or seeking to strengthen your faith, you have, willy-nilly, already been about the doing of the mission you were given. Born into this time in between, you have found his hand again and reclasped it. You are therefore ready to go on with his spirit to tackle together what you came here to do, the other parts of your mission. Some random comments about your second mission in life. Your second mission here on earth is also one that you share with the rest of the human race, but it is no less your individual mission for the fact that it is shared, and that is to do what you can moment by moment, day by day, step by step, to make this world a better place, following the leading and guidance of God's Spirit within you and around you. Comment 1. The uncomfortableness of one step at a time. Imagine yourself out walking in your neighborhood one night, and suddenly you find yourself surrounded by such a dense fog that you have lost your bearings and cannot find your way. Suddenly, a friend appears out of the fog and asks you to put your hand in theirs, and they will lead you home. And you, not being able to tell where you are going, trustingly follow them, even though you can only see one step at a time. Eventually, you arrive safely home, filled with gratitude. But as you reflect upon the experience the next day, you realize how unsettling it was to have to keep walking when you could see only one step at a time, even though you had guidance you knew you could trust. Now, I have asked you to imagine all of this because this is the essence of the second mission to which you are called and I am called in this life. It is all very different than we had imagined. When the question, what is your mission in life, is first broached, and we have put our hand in God's, as it were, we imagine that we will be taken up to some mountaintop, from which we can see far into the distance, and that we will hear a voice in our ear saying, "Look, look, see that distant city? That is the goal of your mission. That is where everything is leading, every step of your way." But instead of the mountaintop, we find ourselves in the valley, wandering often in a fog. And the voice in our ear says something quite different from what we thought we would hear. It says, "Your mission is to take one step at a time, even when you don't yet see where it is all leading, or what the grand plan is, or what your overall mission in life is. Trust me, I will lead you." Comment 2. The nature of this step-by-step mission. As I said, in every situation you find yourself, you have been sent here to do whatever you can, moment by moment, that will bring more gratitude, more kindness, more forgiveness, more honesty, and more love into this world. There are dozens of such moments every day, moments when you stand, as it were, at a spiritual crossroads, with two ways lying before you. Such moments are typically called moments of decision. It does not matter what the frame or content of each particular decision is. It all devolves, in the end, into just two roads before you, every time. The one will lead to less gratitude, less kindness, less forgiveness, less honesty, and less love in the world. The other will lead to more gratitude, more kindness, more forgiveness, more honesty, or more love in the world. Your mission, each moment, is to seek to choose the latter spiritual road rather than the former every time. Comment 3. Some examples of this step-by-step mission. I will give a few examples so that the nature of this part of your mission may be unmistakably clear. You are out on the freeway in your car. Someone has gotten into the wrong lane, to the right of your lane, and needs to move over into the lane you are in. You see their need to cut in ahead of you. Decision time. In your mind's eye, you see two spiritual roads lying before you. The one leading to less kindness in the world. You speed up to shut this driver out and don't let them move over. The other leading to more kindness in the world. You let the driver cut in. Since you know this is part of your mission, part of the reason why you came to Earth, your calling is clear. You know which road to take, which decision to make. You are hard at work at your desk when suddenly an interruption comes. The phone rings or someone is at the door. They need something from you, a question of some of your time and attention. Decision time. In your mind's eye, you see two spiritual roads lying before you. The one leading to less love in the world. You tell them you're just too busy to be bothered. The other leading to more love in the world. You put aside your work, decide that God may have sent this person to you, and say, "Yes, what can I do to help you?" Since you know this is part of your mission, part of the reason why you came to Earth, your calling is clear. You know which road to take, which decision to make. Your mate does something that hurts your feelings. Decision time. In your mind's eye, you see two spiritual roads lying before you. The one leading to less forgiveness in the world. You institute an icy silence between the two of you and think of how you can punish them or otherwise get even. The other leading to more forgiveness in the world. You go over and take them in your arms, speak the truth about your hurt feelings, and assure them of your love. Since you know this is part of your mission, part of the reason why you came to Earth, your calling is clear. You know which road to take, which decision to make. You have not behaved at your most noble recently, and now you are face to face with someone who asks you a question about what happened. Decision time. In your mind's eye, you see two spiritual roads lying before you, the one leading to less honesty in the world. You lie about what happened or what you were feeling because you fear losing their respect or their love. The other leading to more honesty in the world. You tell the truth, together with how you feel about it in retrospect. Since you know this is part of your mission, part of the reason why you came to Earth, your calling is clear. You know which road to take, which decision to make. Comment 4. The spectacle that makes the angels laugh. It is necessary to explain this part of our mission in some detail because so many times you will see people wringing their hands and saying, "I want to know what my mission in life is." All the while, they are cutting people off on the highway, refusing to give time to people, punishing their mate for having hurt their feelings, and lying about what they did. And it will seem to you that the angels must laugh to see this spectacle. For these people wringing their hands, their mission was right there, on the freeway, in the interruption, in the hurt, and at the confrontation. Comment 5. The valley versus the mountaintop. At some point in your life, your mission may involve some grand mountaintop experience where you say to yourself, this is why I came into the world. I know it. But until then, your mission is here in the valley and the fog, and the little callings moment by moment, day by day. More to the point, it is likely you cannot ever get to your mountaintop mission unless you have first exercised your stewardship faithfully in the valley. It is an ancient principle, to which Jesus alluded often, that if you don't use the information the universe has already given you, you cannot expect it will give you any more. If you aren't being faithful in small things, how can you expect to be given charge over larger things? Luke chapter 16 verses 10 through 12, chapter 19, verses 11 through 24. If you aren't trying to bring more gratitude, kindness, forgiveness, honesty, and love into the world each day, you can hardly expect that you will be entrusted with the mission to help bring peace into the world or anything else large and important. If we do not live out our day-by-day mission in the valley, we cannot expect we are yet ready for a larger mountaintop mission. Comment 6. The importance of not thinking of this mission as just a training camp. The valley is not just a kind of training camp. There is, in your imagination, even now, an invisible spiritual mountaintop to which you may go if you wish to see where all this is leading. And what will you see there, in the imagination of your heart, but the goal toward which all this is pointed? That earth might be more like heaven, that human life might be more like God's. That is the large achievement toward which all our day-to-day missions in the valley are moving. This is a large order, but it is accomplished by faithful attention to the doing of our great Creator's will in little things as well as in large. It is much like the building of the pyramids in Egypt, which was accomplished by the dragging of a lot of individual pieces of stone by a lot of individual men. The valley, the fog, the going step by step, is no mere training camp. The goal is real, however large. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Some random comments about your third mission in life. Your third mission here on earth is one that is uniquely yours, and that is, A, to exercise the talent that you particularly came to earth to use, your greatest gift that you most delight to use. B, in those places or settings that God has caused to appeal to you the most. C, and for those purposes that God most needs to have done in the world. Comment 1. Our mission is already written in our members. It is customary, in trying to identify this part of our mission, to advise that we should ask God in prayer to speak to us and tell us plainly what our mission is. We look for a voice in the air, a thought in our head, a dream in the night, a sign in the events of the day, to reveal this thing that is otherwise, it is said, completely hidden. Sometimes, from just such answered prayer, people do indeed discover what their mission is beyond all doubt and uncertainty. But having to wait for the voice of God to reveal what our mission is not the truest picture of our situation. St. Paul, in Romans, speaks of a law written in our members, and this phrase has a telling application to the question of how God reveals to each of us our unique mission in life. Read again the definition of our third mission, and you will see the clear implication of the definition is that God has already revealed His will to us concerning our vocation and mission by causing it to be written in our members. We are to begin deciphering our unique mission by studying our talents and skills, and more particularly, which ones, or one, we most rejoice to use. God actually has written His will twice in our members. First, in the talents that He lodged there, and second, in His guidance of our heart, as to which talent gives us the greatest pleasure from its exercise. It is usually the one that, when we use it, causes us to lose all sense of time. Even as the anthropologist can examine ancient inscriptions and divine from them the daily life of a long-lost people, so we, by examining our talents and our heart, can more often than we dream divine the will of the living God. For true it is, our mission is not something He will reveal, it is something He has already revealed. It is not to be found written in the sky. It is to be found written in our members. Comment 2. Career counseling, we need you. Arguably, our first two missions in life could be learned from religion alone. without any reference whatsoever to career counseling, the subject of this book. Why then should career counseling claim that this question about our mission in life is its proper concern in any way? It is when we come to this third mission, which hinges so crucially on the question of our talents, skills, and gifts, that we see the answer. If you've read the body of this book before turning to this section, then you know without my even saying it how much the identification of talents, gifts, or skills is the province of career counseling. Its expertise, indeed its raison d'être, lies precisely in the identification, classification, and, forgive me, prioritization of talents, skills, and gifts. To put the matter quite simply, career counseling knows how to do this better than any other discipline, including traditional religion. This is not a defect of religion, but the fulfillment of something Jesus promised. When the Spirit of truth comes, He will guide you into all truth. John chapter 16, verse 13. Career counseling is part, we may hope, of that promised late coming truth. It can therefore be of inestimable help to the pilgrim who is trying to figure out what their greatest and most enjoyable talent is as a step toward identifying their unique mission in life. If career counseling needs religion as its helpmate in the first two stages of identifying our mission in life, then religion repays the compliment by clearly needing career counseling as its helpmate here in the third stage. And this place where you are in your life right now, facing the job hunt and all its anxiety, is the perfect time to seek the union within your own mind and heart of both career counseling, as in the pages of this book, and your faith in God. Comment 3. How Our Mission Got Chosen, a Scenario for the Romantic. It is a mystery that we cannot fathom, in this life at least, as to why one of us has this talent and the other one has that. Why God chose to give one gift and mission to one person and a different gift and mission to another. Since we do not know, and in some degree cannot know, we are certainly left free to speculate and imagine. We may imagine that before we came to earth, our souls, our breath, our light, stood before the great Creator and volunteered for this mission. And God and we together chose what that mission would be and what particular gifts would be needed, which He then agreed to give us after our birth. Thus, our mission was not a command given peremptorily by an unloving Creator to a reluctant slave without a vote, but was a task jointly designed by us both, in which as fast as the great Creator said, "I wish," our hearts responded, "Oh, yes." As mentioned in an earlier comment, it may be helpful to think of the condition of our becoming human as that we became amnesiac about any consciousness our soul had before birth, and therefore amnesiac about the nature or manner in which our mission was designed. Our searching for our mission now is therefore a searching to recover the memory of something we ourselves had a part in designing. I am admittedly a hopeless romantic. So, of course, I like this picture. If you also are a hopeless romantic, you may like it too. There's also the chance that it just may be true. We will not know until we see Him face to face. Comment 4. Mission as Intersection. There are all different kinds of voices calling you to all different kinds of work. And the problem is to find out which is the voice of God rather than that of society, say, or the superego, or self-interest. By and large, a good rule for finding out is this. The kind of work God usually calls you to is the kind of work, A, that you need most to do, and B, the world most needs to have done. If you really get a kick out of your work, you've presumably met requirement A. But if your work is writing TV deodorant commercials, the chances are you've missed requirement B. On the other hand, if your work is being a doctor in a leper colony, you have probably met B, but if most of the time you're bored and depressed by it, the chances are you haven't only bypassed A, but probably aren't helping your patients much either. Neither the hair shirt nor the soft berth will do. The place God calls you to is the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. Fred Buechner, Wishful Thinking, A Theological ABC. Comment 5. Examples of Mission as Intersection. Your unique and individual mission will most likely turn out to be a mission of love, acted out in one or all of the three arenas, either in the kingdom of the mind, whose goal is to bring more truth into the world, or in the kingdom of the heart, whose goal is to bring more beauty into the world, or in the kingdom of the will, whose goal is to bring more perfection into the world through service. Here are some examples. My mission is, out of the rich reservoir of love that God seems to have given me, to nurture and show love to others, most particularly those who are suffering from incurable diseases. My mission is to draw maps for people to show them how to get to God. My mission is to create the purest foods I can to help people's bodies not get in the way of their spiritual growth. My mission is to make the finest harps I can so that people can hear the voice of God in the wind. My mission is to make people laugh so that the travail of this earthly life doesn't seem quite so hard to them. My mission is to help people know the truth in love about what is happening out in the world, so that there will be more honesty in the world. My mission is to weep with those who weep, so that in my arms they may feel themselves in the arms of that eternal love that sent me and that created them. My mission is to create beautiful gardens, so that in the lilies of the field people may behold the beauty of God and be reminded of the beauty of holiness. Comment 6. Life as long as your mission requires. Knowing that you came to earth for a reason, and knowing what that mission is, throws an entirely different light upon your life from now on. You are, generally speaking, delivered from any further fear about how long you have to live. You may settle it in your heart that you are here until God chooses to think that you have accomplished your mission, or until God has a greater mission for you in another realm. You need to be a good steward of what he has given you while you are here, but you do not need to be an anxious steward or stewardess. You need to attend to your health, but you do not need to constantly worry about it. You need to meditate on your death, but you do not need to be constantly preoccupied with it. To paraphrase the glorious words of G.K. Chesterton, "We now have a strong desire for living, combined with a strange carelessness about dying. We desire life like water, and yet are ready to drink death like wine." We know that we are here to do what we came to do, and we need not worry about anything else. Comment 7. Using Internet Resources. There is a website that deals with news, etc., about all faiths, which you may want to look at. www.beliefnet.com. Then there is a Jesuit site that leads you in a daily meditation for 10 or more minutes, in more than 20 languages with a visual, but otherwise no sound or distraction. http://sacredspace.ie. There is also a site that gives you a daily podcast of church bells, music, scripture reading, and meditations or homily, with no visuals but with sound, and an audio MP3 file that can be sent to your phone, computer, PDA, etc. www.pray-as-you-go.org. There is a site dedicated to helping you keep a divine consciousness 24/7 by helping you link up to other people of faith through prayer circles, sharing of personal stories of faith, etc., aimed especially but not exclusively toward young adults. Its ultimate message, you are not alone. www.pray-as-you-go.org. www.24-7prayer.com/communities. Lastly, there is a site dedicated to help you find a spiritual counselor or spiritual director, as well as retreat centers in the Christian, Islamic, Buddhist, Jewish, or interfaith faiths. www.sdiworld.org. Final comment, a job hunt done well. If you approach your job hunt as an opportunity to work on this issue as well as the issue of how you will keep body and soul together, then hopefully your job hunt will end with your being able to say, "Life has deep meaning to me now. I have discovered more than my ideal job. I have found my mission and the reason why I am here on Earth." Appendix B, a guide to dealing with your feelings while out of work. Unemployment can take a terrible toll upon the human spirit. In a study of over 6,000 job hunters interviewed every week for up to 24 weeks, it was found that many workers become discouraged the longer they are unemployed. In particular, the unemployed express feeling more sad the longer they are unemployed, and sadness rises more quickly with unemployment duration during episodes of job search. In addition, reported life satisfaction is lower for the same individual following days in which comparatively more time was devoted to job search. These findings suggest that the psychological cost of job search rises the longer someone is unemployed. One reason why job search assistants may have been found to consistently speed individuals' return to work in past studies is that it may help the unemployed to overcome feelings of anxiety and sadness that are associated with job search. I know the truth of this from my own experience. I have been fired twice in my life. I remember how it felt each time I got the lousy news. I walked out of the building dazed, as though I had just emerged from a really bad train wreck. The sun was shining brightly, not a cloud in the sky, and since it was lunch hour, as it happened, the streets were filled with laughing, happy people who apparently had not a care in the world. I remember thinking, the world has just caved, my world at least. How can all these people act as though nothing has happened? And I remember the feelings, the overwhelming feelings that only intensified in the weeks after that. Describe my state however you want. Feeling sad, being in a funk, feeling despair, feeling hopeless, feeling like things will always be this way, or feeling depressed. It doesn't matter. I was terribly unhappy. Unemployment was rocking my soul to its foundations. I needed to know what to do about my feelings. I have since learned that my experience was not the least unusual. Many of us, if not most of us, when we are out of work for a long time, feel weary and depressed. Serious clinical depression often has a lifelong history and requires treatment, particularly when a person is feeling endangering impulses, such as suicide. In such a case, you should seek competent psychological or psychiatric help. For immediate help, this minute, call 1-800-273-8255. Or go online to www.suicidepreventionlifeline.org. There are counselors 24/7 at both places who deal with anyone, including the military or veterans, in trouble. Our greatest desire is to get rid of these depressed feelings. After talking to thousands of job hunters, I think there are 10 things we can do to deal with our feelings when we are unemployed. 1. We can catch up on our sleep, even if it means we have to take naps during the day because our attempt to sleep at nighttime is, at the moment, a disaster. We tend to feel depressed if we are short on our sleep or our body is otherwise run down. There are two states that can be easily confused. First of all, the world never looks bright or happy to us when we are very short on sleep. Secondly, the world never looks bright or happy to us when we are feeling depressed. It is therefore easy to confuse the two feeling states. Over the years, I have seen many job hunters who first thought they were really depressed over their situation, later discover they were really depressed just because they were so tired, or a bit of both. Anyway, sleep or nap, we often turn into happier, more upbeat people